Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Picture yourself in heaven. Now ask yourself, where does that picture come from? Given that nobody knows exactly what happens to human souls when bodies die, if indeed anything happens at all, we spend a remarkable amount of time thinking about life beyond the grave. As my guest will tell us, our notions of life after death have been informed in part by our culture, which in turn draws on narratives of heaven, hell, and purgatory to make sense of the things we experience in our mortal lives. Greg Garrett is a professor at Baylor University, where he teaches classes on writing, film, pop culture, and theology. He's also a licensed lay preacher in the Episcopal Church and author of the new book, Entertaining Judgment, The Afterlife in Popular Imagination. Greg, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. It's a joy to be on with you today.
Let's start with this. Part of the reason our interpretations of the afterlife are so open to speculation is that there is just very little written about them in sacred texts.
That's right. In the Old Testament and New Testament, we find little pieces here and there, and there really isn't enough to put together a coherent picture. And even if we trusted those things, we're still dealing with our attempt to understand with the human intellect something that, if you're a person of faith, you believe is actually sort of outside of our ability to comprehend. And so when we put together these pictures, the tiny little pieces of it we get from Scripture are things like streets of gold, which is it's a way of communicating something to us from our earthly life, but probably doesn't much resemble what an actual afterlife might look like. So because there's so little information, at least in the Judeo-Christian tradition, we tend to rely on writers, artists, other kinds of imagination, as well as theological imagination, to try and fill in those gaps and try and figure out for ourselves, well, what is it that comes after this life? And, you know, what do those options look like? And how does that, you know, shape the way that I live my life now?
Where did the notions of, like, angels and harps and clouds arise?
Well, a lot of that is extrapolated out of the sacred texts. But much of it also comes from our popular art. And there are certain periods, Renaissance, Victorian, and today, honestly, where we get all of these pictures of angels that are sort of cutesy, baby anime angels or, you know, sort of beautiful winged guardian angels. In the scriptural record, what we actually hear are things like six-winged seraphim. They are sort of awesome and awe-inspiring and, frankly, frightening creatures. And I don't think we like those angels so much. And so we've sort of reshaped them into an image that's a little bit more usable. So we've domesticated angels in our imagery and in the stories that we tell about them, so that we don't have to sort of wrestle with the implications of if these things are real. Wow, they are sort of beyond our ability to understand, and they would probably freak me out if one were actually in front of me.
I'm not sure that that's what I was told heaven was when I was a child, but I guess it's what I pictured. And I recall thinking that it sounded a little boring, and the nuns at my school would assure me, don't worry, it's just so much better than anything you can picture that no one can describe it.
Yeah, that's sort of the way that I hope we try and understand it. I have a number of relatives who have put together in their heads that sort of streets of gold, mansions. You know, I'm gonna walk streets of gold and live in a mansion and wear a crown. And that's a particularly enticing version of heaven, I think, for people who experience hardship in this life. It sort of gives some credence to the Marxist ideas from the 19th century that in some ways religion is an opiate, because you have this sense at that time and in the Middle Ages that even if this life is horrible, and for many people it is, if you live in a certain way, then you have this reward waiting for you. I think your nuns are probably right. If there is a heaven, it's probably more fantastic, more amazing, greater than anything we can imagine. But again, we're trying to understand it in the only ways that we have, which are human words and human images. And so I think we come up with things like the fluffy cloud heaven that help us at least have some picture of it.
How does heaven come up in movies and books and TV shows and pop songs? What does heaven, if you were to look at it simply from the perspective of the art that we create about it in the modern world, what is heaven?
Well, there's two ways you can look at that question, and I'll take them both quickly. Sometimes you get an actual, we would say, literal depiction of heaven. And so in some movies, you have a character who arrives at the gates of heaven, whether that's Bill and Ted in one of their movies or Warren Beatty in that movie Heaven Can Wait. We get these sort of depictions, and they tend to be sort of stereotypical. But the ones that are actually more interesting to me are the ones where we have a sort of functional heaven, a dramatic heaven instead of an actual heaven. And there I think we see three stories that kind of get acted out. There's one version which is what we might think of as paradise. What are the greatest things that we can think about in this world? You know, the most beautiful settings. There's a sort of a teen romance movie from the 80s, I think, called Paradise, which was a knockoff of Blue Lagoon. And, you know, so you think about tropical paradise. What would it be like to live in a place where you're surrounded by beauty? And so that's one of the archetypes of heaven that we kind of see developed in pop culture. One of the other ones is reconnection with your family and friends, which is a powerful story that we tell about heaven. And so at the end of Les Miserables, play and film, at the end of Titanic, at the end of Places in the Heart, we have gathered together the people who have been important to us. I think one of the things that's interesting about that story, though, is that it tends to be a gated community. In most of those stories, like at the end of Les Miserables, you know, where is the villain? You know, he's not a part of this. At the end of Titanic, you know, where is the terrifying fiance and, you know, those other folks that made life difficult for our heroes? And that's the third story that we tell, is that we think of heaven as a place where we can be with people who we want to be with and can keep out the people we don't want to be with. Hmm. And hence that gated community sort of idea. And we see that in places like the Matrix films, where one of the primary settings is a city called Zion. And there is this very literal attempt to keep out the forces that might destabilize or destroy it.
What do our sacred texts suggest about hell?
Well, there is a lot of disagreement about that among religious people. If you're a person who tends to read the Bible fairly literally, then you think that there's a lot of information about it. If you're a person who reads it a little bit more metaphorically, then you think that there's probably not much. So, for example, when you look in the New Testament, the Christian Testament, sometimes when Jesus says the word hell, or it's translated hell in English versions, he's actually using the term Gehenna, which was a valley outside of Jerusalem where some terrible things happened in historical times. And at that time, it was a garbage dump that was kept burning day and night. And so all of these images of stench and heat and fire, you know, are sort of implicit in that place name that gets translated hell in a lot of our Bibles. So what we think we understand from the sacred record sort of depends on how we interpret. The great New Testament scholar N.T. Wright, who's perhaps the greatest living writer on the New Testament, argues that there is almost nothing about the afterlife in the Judeo-Christian tradition. And he says most of what we think we know comes from Dante. It comes from medieval art and from stained glass. It comes from John Milton's Paradise Lost. And often without our knowing it, which was actually one of the things that most interested me about this book because I began to find these gaps in my own knowledge, often without knowing it, we have filled in things from the cultural record that are not in any kind of biblical record. So these things that we think about, you know, Satan with horns and a tail, you would be hard-pressed to find horns and a tail anywhere in the Bible.
What's really interesting is that I guess a lot of modern theologians couch hell more in terms of a sort of willful separation from God, and that presents a completely different image from an eternity that's filled with like physical pain and punishment.
Yeah, it absolutely does. There are a couple of strains of thought in contemporary theology that I think in some ways reflect some cultural understandings. The Economist, which is one of my favorite magazines, ran a cover story on hell in 2012, which essentially said that hell is closed. And what they said is that, you know, for most, and they said thinking people, and I think they were unfortunately leaving out thinking Christians, but they said for most thinking people, it's impossible to think of a place like hell and actually believe in it. And, of course, the stats tell us that plenty of people in America actually do believe in hell. The stats also tell us that almost none of them believe that they're going there. But the record that we have is that as we get closer and closer to the present, and some liberal theologians begin wrestling with this whole question of how do we reconcile the idea of a loving God and eternal punishment? So in some traditions, that's not a problem. If you're a Calvin or a neo-Calvinist, you understand human beings to be fallen irrevocably and not really even deserving of redemption. And the grace that's extended is, well, you're just lucky to have it, to have that opportunity. And so in some theological traditions, hell makes perfect sense. But there was also this huge stir a couple of years ago when Rob Bell wrote a book called Love Wins. Rob Bell was a sort of self-identified evangelical Christian, and he sort of suggested, maybe hinted at, an idea that for many liberal theologians is taken very seriously. C.S. Lewis also wrote about it, the Anglican writer and theologian, that God really at some point wants to save everyone. And so you have to really choose hell to get there. You have to really choose that separation because otherwise God really wants to extend it to everyone. And so that's two distinct kind of theological traditions separate from that cultural notion that hell is this sort of ridiculous place where the Satan from South Park, you know, walks around and sings musical numbers.
Greg Garrett is with us. He's a professor at Baylor University and a licensed lay preacher in the Episcopal Church. His new book is called Entertaining Judgment, The Afterlife in Popular Imagination. We'll talk more about heaven and hell and get a little purgatory in there as well in a couple of minutes. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Back in 2 minutes with Greg Garrett.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, featuring the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are being accepted for the program, which begins January 20th at SMU in Plano, smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Baylor University Professor Greg Garrett, who is also a licensed lay preacher in the Episcopal Church and author of the new book Entertaining Judgment, The Afterlife in Popular Imagination. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. So, Greg, certainly a belief in heaven and hell can motivate us to behave the way we should, right? We want the reward of heaven. We want to avoid the agony of hell. They also seem to make it possible to exist in a world where the most wicked people appear to go unpunished in some cases, and the best people appear to just, you know, have obstacle after obstacle thrown at them.
Yeah, I think the two sort of central questions that some kind of belief in the afterlife, whether it's an operative belief or a dramatic belief, it lets you answer that question that you just brought up. Why is there so much evil in the universe? And then the second question, is there justice of some kind? And if heaven allows us to think, I was listening actually to Colin Cowherd on ESPN this morning, and he said, although I am an agnostic, I have beliefs about heaven and hell, and here's what I think. And he said, you know, there are rules in heaven. Kind people get in. People who tell the truth get in. In hell, there are no rules and no truth. And so, you know, even for Colin Cowherd, who's saying, you know, I'm not a religious person, yet when I think about heaven and hell, here's how they help me make sense of my life. It encourages me to believe then that there is punishment for the evil that goes unpunished in this life and reward for the people who are unrewarded somehow in this life. And I guess the third thing that sort of opens up for us is the large kind of existential question, is the universe itself, is it benign or malignant? Does the universe care about us? Stephen Crane in one of his poems said, you know, basically the universe does not care about you. Go on about your business. It doesn't matter what you do. But that's a hard way to live your life. And so not just for people of faith, but even for people who think, you know, I'm not sure that I could go in this direction, but I really want to believe that there is some kind of order or meaning that I'm not necessarily seeing. Heaven and hell and purgatory, for that matter, also help us to have some sort of way to order our lives now. And if there isn't a heaven or hell, at least they've given us the opportunity to have a better life in this existence.
So heaven and hell at least get some mentions in Judeo-Christian texts, but how and when did the sort of extra-biblical idea of purgatory enter our consciousness?
Well, you know, it comes about pretty early in the Christian tradition. There are a couple of Bible verses that hint at it. Things like there's a verse from the Gospels that talks about how this particular sin will not be forgiven in this life or in the next. So the idea is that there's still forgiveness going on in another frame of existence after life. I think it sort of grew out of this very simple idea in Christian theology that even the most pure and perfect of human beings still are not ready to come before the throne of God, to come into the presence of God, the high, the mighty, the perfect, the true, the just. And so as we go through the first couple of centuries of the church, we have this ongoing sort of developing idea. Maybe there is a way station on the way, kind of like, you know, King's Cross Station at the end of Harry Potter. It's like, I'm going to stop here for a while. I'm going to decide what direction I want to go, whether I want to go up or down, on or back. And then the sort of genius that we find coming into the question of purgatory is Dante. Not long after the church sort of adopts it as official dogma, we've got Dante writing Inferno, Purgatorio, those, you know, the three sort of central texts about how we understand the afterlife. And he was able to take in his poetry and shape and frame some of the theological debates, some of the images that had been circulating, some of the ideas about this idea of improvement, purgation movement, and to make it believable for a vast number of people. And, you know, purgatory's problem is not that it's not dramatically logical, because it's basically the basis for almost every story that we tell. You know, characters go through hell, so to speak, and they gain this hard-won personal knowledge, and they come out on the other side of the experience as a changed person. I mean, that's almost every great story that there is. But the purgatory story ran into trouble in the Middle Ages with the granting of indulgences and the idea that people could get out, you know, get out of jail free, so to speak, for making contributions and for doing certain actions. And that actually is still going on. I noticed that the Vatican said that you could earn indulgences for following Pope Francis on Twitter.
That, of course, is a joke.
I wish it were. I think that's actually true.
Is the church literally offering indulgences?
They said that it is possible because there are some things like worldwide kind of events that he was going to be involved in. And so they were saying for people who cannot, let's say, make the pilgrimage to this, you can follow Francis's tweets about the event and get the spiritual benefit of it, which is sort of what the indulgences amount to. It's some time served, basically.
Well, the thing about purgatory, the idea of purgatory, and there are a lot of, you know, mainstream Christian denominations outside of Catholicism that have rejected that and sort of stand by that. But if we look at ourselves, it feels like it makes sense, right? Because we know that we might be good but not perfect. We know that we might be bad but not horrible. And if we have to decide between, you know, sort of eternal reward or eternal damnation, most of us want to know that there's like a loophole that we can fall into.
That there's like a loophole. And it's really interesting because most of the representations of purgatory are basically hell with an escape hatch. And that's true from sort of the first medieval renderings of it in art and in stained glass, kind of up to the present. If you read James Joyce as he writes about a sermon on hell and purgatory, if you read some 19th century Jesuits talking about purgatory, basically they're talking about fire, you know, like the punishment that will burn away all the impurities. It kind of misses what Dante has in his Purgatorio, which is a place that's not overseen by demons but overseen by angels. And you sort of get the sense that in a very real way, if you're in purgatory, it's a good thing, not a bad thing. And it also, I think, is true to human nature. We know from our own experience that we don't generally make the necessary changes in our lives voluntarily. We have to have something happen to us almost all the time. At least that's been the way in my own life. We have to go through this experience of purging, the difficult, the hellish. And then we have that chance to say, okay, I'm going to choose differently. I'm going to be a different person. I'm going to come out on the other side, a changed human being. And that's why one of my favorite versions of purgatory in imaginative literature as Groundhog Day.
Right.
It's been taught a lot of different ways. Buddhists look at it as a thing on mindfulness and cycles. But a lot of times when it's looked at by people who are Judeo-Christian, they think of it as this sort of testing and purgation. And he has to become a totally different person. The Bill Murray at the beginning of the movie does not deserve salvation. He doesn't deserve the girl. The one at the end does. And he has become this changed person because he has gone through this, you know, it's not a fixed period of time. I talked with Danny Rubin, the screenwriter of Groundhog Day, a couple of months ago, and he said, I don't know how long it is. You know, there's some intriguing theories on the internet. But he says it's as long as it needs to be, which I guess is the idea behind purgatory. It's as long as it needs to be to make you the person you need to be.
Another interesting purgatory narrative that you identify in the book is the story of Oskar Schindler as presented in the movie Schindler's List.
Yeah. There are a couple of stories that I talked about where the characters are going through a kind of purgatory experience, but the viewers or readers are also going through a kind of purgatory experience. And I'm sure your listeners can think of movies or plays or stories that were powerful and really difficult that sort of pulled them into the emotion of the story and were in some ways a kind of trial for them as well. And so I talked about the experience of watching Schindler's List or the experience of watching 12 Years a Slave more recently, where you sort of feel like you are undergoing a spiritual beating, enduring all of these horrors. And then you come out on the other side and you have the chance, not just the characters in the film. Oskar Schindler changes. You know, the character in 12 Years a Slave comes out on the other side, as we hope, a different character, although there's not a whole lot of dramatic reward given to him at the end of that story. But it's also us as the viewers or as the audience who have the chance to say, I have been through this purgatory experience and I wrestled and it was hard. And now here I am on the other side. And I think I see the world and maybe even myself a little bit differently as a result of this experience.
My son had to watch Gone with the Wind over the weekend for a school assignment, and it's a problematic story for a lot of reasons now, based on our understanding of race and slavery. But the basic story of Scarlett O'Hara struck me because in some ways, it's like a classic purgatory narrative, and at the end of it, Scarlett has been kind of purified. Her best friend dies. The man she had a crush on is not available to her. Her husband leaves her, and yet she's realized the error of her ways, and she doesn't move on. Yeah. She doesn't take that next step up to heaven. She's kind of left with nothing at the end.
And that, I think, is kind of the benefit of the purgatory story for us because, we don't get to go directly to heaven. We get cycled back into our lives and, you know, we are going to go on until the next purgatory story comes along because there will be another one the next time we need to have some kind of great personal change or growth. But what I do love about that narrative is the sense that, you know, she is a stronger character. She knows something about herself at the end of the movie that she didn't know at the beginning. And, you know, even though she doesn't cycle out into another form of existence, she is a different person, which is kind of the goal of that story. One of my other favorite purgatory stories is in Bruges. And it's that that great movie where the two hitmen go to hide out in Bruges after one of them has accidentally shot a priest during a hit that's gone wrong. And there are all these images of purgatory and a lot of talk about the afterlife. You know, do you deserve to be in hell, heaven, or purgatory? And this very real sense that these characters are going through a purgatory experience, and if they survive it, they come out on the other side. They're going to be changed in some way. And I really love that the Colin Farrell character, the younger hitman, at the end of that movie, who's the person who was sort of the guilty person in shooting a priest and a child at the beginning of the movie. He has come to the point where he's willing to accept whatever it is that's going to have to happen to him. Which is something that he was not able to do early on. But he says, you know, I'm going to go to that mother and I'm going to say, whatever it is that you think ought to happen to me, I'm willing to accept it. And that's an amazing sort of hard-won personal knowledge that comes as a result of being in Bruges.
Greg Garrett is my guest. He's professor at Baylor University and a licensed lay preacher in the Episcopal Church. His new book is called Entertaining Judgment, The Afterlife in Popular Imagination. You can be part of the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. We'll talk more with Greg in a few minutes. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, featuring the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are being accepted for the program, which begins January 20th at SMU in Plano, smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Baylor University Professor Greg Garrett, whose new book is called Entertaining Judgment, The Afterlife in Popular Imagination. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. And Greg, a number of people have pointed out that there are some descriptions and discussions of heaven and hell in the Quran. And in fact, I don't want to make it seem as if you didn't consider these a bit in your research for the book.
No, I absolutely did. There is a lot more detail about heaven and hell, about angels and demons in the Quran and in some of the other core Islamic texts. I do talk about that some in the book. It's not my area of expertise, and so I don't want to in any way misrepresent it. So it's sort of my observation that, yes, there is a whole lot more. The angels are much more prominent characters, so to speak, and are active throughout those sacred texts. And there are actual descriptions where, we enter into heaven and see what that looks like in that tradition. And so that is, I mean, of the three Abrahamic faiths, that's the tradition that has the most sort of concrete speculation about the afterlife and the sort of citizens of the afterlife out of those three.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Maurice in Fort Worth. Hi, Maurice.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well, thanks.
I want to go back to what the Bible speaks of hell as eternal fire, and what does that mean? Over in Jude 7, it says how Sodom and Gomorrah suffered, quote-unquote, the vengeance of eternal fire. Well, if eternal fire means ever-burning fire, are Sodom and Gomorrah still burning today?
Any thoughts on that, Greg?
That is a great question. I would have to probably look at the Greek in Jude and see what words are being used there for eternal and fire. I think we know that sort of literally Sodom and Gomorrah, the actual cities, are not burning today. But I think figuratively we can think of the inhabitants as being a part of that everlasting punishment. That might be a way to approach that passage.
Plenty of people who believe in heaven and hell do not believe in things like vampires and ghosts and zombies, but boy, we sure love stories about them. They scare us, but often, in the last couple of hundred years, we've also been encouraged to kind of pity them. Like, we don't want to be in their shoes even if they are immortal. Are these narratives about people caught between life and death, are they about coming to terms with the reality and even the rightness of human mortality?
I think that's a part of it, because with each of these sort of main characters in the undead story, the ghost, the zombie, and the vampire, you've got people who are somehow in between, and there are different versions of that. There are people who are mostly spirit and people who are mostly body, but in each of those stories, we are trying to figure out something about what it means to be alive or dead, about where that boundary comes, and particularly with characters like vampires, I think we are wrestling with some big sort of spiritual questions. What does eternal life look like? In recent years, of course, we've had this influx of a slightly different vampire story. When Stephanie Meyer wrote Twilight, it created this sensation. A couple of years ago, one out of every six books sold in America was a Twilight novel.
Wow.
And, of course, the movies have been phenomenally popular. And that's a story that sort of recasts the vampire a little bit. It's still a beautiful creature, but it doesn't seem to have the downside for the most part. You know, they're sparkly, they can go out in the daytime, and they can find eternal love. And that actually fits in not just with Stephanie Meyer's theology, she's a member of the Church of Latter-day Saints, but also with a lot of mainstream Christians. My grandma Irene, who is a lifelong member of a charismatic Christian church, talks about how she cannot wait to get to heaven to see my grandpa and sit on his lap through all eternity. And, so in some ways we're coming back in that story to the idea that we had that heaven, whatever it's going to be like, eternal life worth living is going to be a life where we're reunited with the people that we lived and loved, lived with and loved in this life.
So there is so much longing to sort of reunite with the people that we miss if we are able to make it to heaven. You point out that the purgatory narratives are interesting because sometimes people in purgatory require a little help from the people still on earth. My grandmother used to say if something went wrong, she would say, offer that up for the poor souls in purgatory, like take on this suffering to sort of help with their redemption. And that's an appealing notion for us somehow.
It's an appealing notion, and it's one that seems to go back as far as we can understand human history. One of the great books that I used in writing Entertainment Judgment is a book called After Lives, which is also from Oxford Press, and it looks at the afterlife back into prehistory, really. There has always been this sense that we are in some way the living. We still somehow have a relationship with the dead. And that relationship can go two ways. We can be frightened by them and worried that they're going to come back and bother us in this life. But we can also have this relationship that talks about how we can continue holding them in our hearts and maybe even learning from them. The great Texas novelist Sarah Bird, in her new novel Above the East China Sea, talks about the relationship of in Okinawan traditional religion between the ancestors and the people who are still alive. And it's very much this purgatorial idea that there's a relationship between the living and the dead, that each can still help the other in some way. And I think, you know, in our most rational selves may say, well, I don't understand how that can possibly be. There's alive and then there's dead. But there is something appealing about that idea that the people who are gone are not really gone and that we can still have some sort of effect on them as they still have some sort of effect on us.
Let's go back to the phone now. This time we have Zach on the line in Dallas. Hey, Zach.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Well, I was just wondering your thoughts on the whole concept of reincarnation of human souls.
What do we see about reincarnation in popular culture and entertainment? Did you look at that at all, Greg?
Not much. That would have been one of the things that sort of fits into the chapter about death and, you know, what comes after. And primarily what I was looking at in this book were the images of heaven, hell, and purgatory. In pop culture, and this is just going to be more of an off-the-cuff answer because it's not something that I spent a whole lot of time thinking about for this book, but we do get these ideas of reincarnation in some places, that we are put in another life and given a chance to work something out. And I think in some ways it's similar to the purgatory narrative, but maybe the best place that we can see it is in the last season of the TV show Lost, where we have these characters who have sort of different existences. J.J. Abrams and the folks who started up that show originally dealt with all of these fan rumors about the island being purgatory, and they denied those. But what they did admit later on was that this sideways world where the characters were living a reality where they never went to the island was a place where that they were actually living another life. And in a purgatorial sense, they were getting the chance to get things right. And then in this sort of reincarnation sense, they were taken from the life that they had lived on the island into this life to try and get some things right that they failed in the previous life. And one of the great episodes of Lost is called Dr. Linus. And Linus was one of the villains in the series. And in that sixth season, he began to move toward redemption. And in that sideways world, he was presented with a choice that on the island he made in a certain way, a selfish way. And then in this new life, he made it in a different way, even though it was to his own detriment. And we sort of see that self-improvement moving toward redemption idea of reincarnation, that you can become a better person in your next life by learning from the failures of lives past.
Obviously, as a man of faith, these are questions that you have considered in relationship to your understanding of God and the nature of the universe. Were you surprised, though, that when you set about to look at this from a rather, you know, secular perspective in the way that just culture looks at these things, at how much societies need heaven and hell and purgatory, even if individuals within those societies don't believe them to be real things?
Yeah. I was a little bit, and just to sort of fold a little bit of my personal story in here, I was raised in a conservative Christian tradition where the afterlife was very important. It was the central part of our faith. And then I was nothing for a long time. And then I came back to the Episcopal Church. And there's no sort of uniformity in belief in the Episcopal Church. There are some people who believe very literally that there is a heaven, that there is a hell. There are some people who say we've got to read those things figuratively and that heaven and hell are here and we make our own choices. Having to wrestle with these questions personally made me think about the afterlife in a very serious way for the first time in a long time, because I'm not part of a tradition where it's the central be-all and end-all. But the other thing that came out of writing the book for me was how many everyday real-life questions get answered by telling these stories about the afterlife, by wrestling with them. So like when Colin Cowherd was saying, here's how I imagine heaven and hell, what he was actually saying is that here is how I imagine our lives and how we live our lives right now have an impact on what might happen to us later, if there is a later. So the afterlife stories, we said already, they're about evil and suffering, about justice, but they're also about how we live now and what we understand death to be and whether it's an end or a new beginning. And all of those afterlife questions, which could be irrelevant in some way, turn out to be absolutely relevant to the way we live and make ethical choices and direct our energy and our passion in this life.
Greg Garrett is a professor at Baylor University, where he teaches classes on writing, film, pop culture, and theology. He is also a licensed lay preacher in the Episcopal Church and author of the new book, Entertaining Judgment, The Afterlife in Popular Imagination. Greg, thank you so much for being part of the conversation.
Chris, it was my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much.